all bad things. Tragedy.
Tragedies, disasters. Bad things.
Trigger warning for everything possible.
What?
I'm Rachel.
And I'm David.
And this is All Bad Things.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome.
Follow us. Insta, X, Facebook, TikTok, Twitch, Threads, and Blue Sky at All Bad Things Pod. Email us allbadthingspod@gmail.com. Join our Facebook discussion group, our subreddit, and our Discord.
Do all of those things.
Like a pro.
Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. How'd Colin Morikawa do for your $4?
He lost it. Yeah, when we were recording our episode last week, he decided to lose four strokes in that time we were recording because he was 7 under, tied for the lead when we were recording. Mm-hmm. Then when we got done, they came out. He was 3 under and like in 5th place. I'm like, okay. So he's not winning.
See, I ask because our focus group said that they really love when we talk golf.
I'm sure they did.
It's all right. It's playoff portion of the hockey season, so
it's about to begin.
Yeah, so there'll be plenty of hockey talk too.
There will. Hockey talk.
Talky hawk.
Honky talk.
Honky tonk.
Talky hawk.
She's a hockey talk woman.
Yes.
Anyway, you want to try see if mango kombucha works for you?
I think I tried
you?
This last
Did
week.
Did you?
Think so.
No, peach. I had last week. Which I liked that one. I saw it.
Yeah, just now. Yeah.
Does it still taste sour to you?
Yeah.
See, it tastes very sweet and very fruity.
Probably because you've drank so much of it. Like, it doesn't, you know what I mean?
I
guess. You have a tolerance for it.
Well,
I like the peach better than that one.
Really?
That was, yeah.
You also didn't like that mocktail I got at that dry bar,
no,
did you?
No, I didn't, no.
It was coconut, unsweetened coconut yogurt based with za'atar and cucumber. Yeah, I thought it was really good, but it was powerful.
Yeah, had some power.
Not in the ABV, because there was zero, but in the flavor department. So, guess what we have today?
What do we have?
A listener's script.
Oh, you're kidding.
This one was just submitted 2 months ago.
Oh, nice. So,
yeah.
Somebody getting in early.
I know.
Usually
exactly.
Takes 2 years.
It's a first timer. So this, I'm going to read the introductory email we got. So, long time listener, first time script submission by Kristen H.
Okay.
Hello, Rachel and David. Attached is a listener script I wrote on this disaster, which I'll mention in a minute.
Okay.
Darn it, I missed it.
What?
I missed the anniversary of this. It was going to be it was the 42nd anniversary of the disaster in March.
Oh, well,
we're months
okay.
behind. Sorry, yeah. Kristen. I start here's some
if you've been a long time listener, you know what the expectations
yes.
are.
Yes. I don't think Kristen expected much more.
Yeah.
And Kristen's pronouns are she, her. She said, this will give a little bit of context clues for the disaster. I started writing this after watching the 2022 documentary film Buried on Netflix, and was consumed by it both because of how beautifully well done the film was and by the disaster itself, having never heard about it before. I realized midway through writing this script that My Favorite Murder covered this disaster back in November of last year, but as much as I love Karen and Georgia, I felt that they rushed over a lot of detail, that's kind of their brand, and that the victims and survivors deserved more time. So I continued with my plan to send it to you both and hope you and my fellow listeners find it as fascinating as I did. I'll mention the sources once we mention the topic. Kristen also says a little bit about me. I've been listening since late 2022. I can't believe that does make her a long-time listener.
Does. It makes her...
Because we've been our...
Makes her potentially 2 years, a year and a half. Anyway.
Yeah.
Late 2022, so...
And love the podcast, including all of David's references to sports as a Western New Yorker living in Buffalo Bills territory.
Ah.
Let's go, Buffalo. As they
where,
say.
I wonder where she lives.
Well, we won't dox her, but...
No. No.
Good point. All the best and thank you for your consideration. Naturally, Kristen. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you.
So, do you have any guesses given those context clues? The documentary Buried, Victims and Survivors. Any thoughts on what this might be or what type of disaster this might be?
An avalanche, I'm guessing.
Ah, yeah. Congratulations. Yeah. Well done.
I didn't see when... I don't know Buried. I don't know that... I was thinking, like... Yeah, you know, like in the ground, like in a...
Oh, yeah, like Buried Alive. Yeah. I always think of Buried Alive.
So, yeah.
Buried, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But when... Yeah, but we're given being in Western New York and lots of snow.
Oh, I gotcha. Yeah, I don't know where this takes place. We will find out. So this is the story of the 1982 Alpine Meadows Avalanche.
Okay.
So, sources... Buried, 1982 Avalanche at Alpine Meadows, 2022, available on Netflix, and various news articles were published following the incident. I also listened to episode 7.5 of the Avalanche Hour podcast by Caleb Merrill. I didn't know there was a whole Avalanche podcast.
If there's a topic, there's a podcast
for there it. There you go, where he talks with the writers, directors, Jared Drake and Steven Sigg about their experiences making the film. All right. Dig right in. Dig right in. Sorry. I didn't mean to be. It was an unintended pun. yeah. This is the story of the deadliest avalanche in North America's history.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Founded in 1961, Alpine Meadows is a ski resort in... Any guesses?
I mean, it sounds like a place in Vermont.
That's a good guess. I would have guessed Colorado.
I think
I associate skiing with Colorado. Do you associate it with Vermont?
Vermont, because I grew up
from there. That makes sense. So it was actually in California.
Near the
northwest shore of Lake Tahoe.
I was going to say, people forget, like, Northern California is, I mean, it's...
Snow country, yeah it's absolutely.
Pretty much on the same latitude as, like, Central New York, so...
Designated as, and it's not near the coast, so it's not tempered by the ocean, yeah. Designated as a Class A avalanche area, that doesn't sound good, by the U.S. Forest Service, the highest class rating, it's recognized as being exceptionally hazardous for its high probability of avalanches.
Sure.
This is due to the ski area's unique climate and terrain, which consists of steep slopes, bowls, and fluctuating temperatures. These conditions are ideal for wind-driven bands of heavy snowfall that result in varying layers of snow density. As a result, Alpine Meadows had to develop a rigorous avalanche control program from the start. The program was largely created and overseen by Bernie Kingery, the 52-year-old. He was not 15, he was 52-year-old. Mountain manager, Jim Plenn, Alpine Meadows avalanche forecaster, who was 33 at the time of the disaster, and Larry Haywood, assistant director of ski patrol, who was 34. Together, they developed an avalanche control regimen based on extensive snow science. Ooh, I'd like to be a snow scientist.
Sure.
You wouldn't like that.
Why wouldn't I?
Because you don't like the cold.
Well, I mean, I don't anymore. But it'd still be fun to be a snow scientist.
You would like to be an oceanographer or a
beach
scientist.
No, because the ocean is fucking dangerous.
A beach scientist. You'd like to be a sand scientist.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
That will forever be our paradox, that I grew up near the beach and want to live in cold weather, and you grew up in cold weather and want to live near the beach.
I mean, not necessarily. I mean, that kind of makes sense. You wanted to get away from the heat. I want to go.
I want to
run towards it.
It kind of does. All right. So they monitored known avalanche starting zones, of which Alpine Meadows has over 300, as well as potential avalanche paths, snow density, wind direction, wind speed, etc., all to assess the risk to the resort and to identify the appropriate control method. The primary method of avalanche control was the use of explosive hand charges. Each morning before the resort was opened, members of ski patrol would ride up the lift, make their way to these starting zones, and then use sticks of gelatin dynamite to try to set off small avalanches at the time of their choosing when everyone was safely out of the way. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, you can't stop the avalanche, but you can time it. You can control
and
the
timing. And you can preempt it, being like, that's going to do this amount of damage, but mm-hmm. we need to get it out of the way before it builds and builds and builds right. and does...
Uh-huh. That's true. Clear it out before it mm-hmm. gets to be more snow. Yeah, that
That's like with digging like sense. Fire lines and cutting out brush. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, they do that in California. Obviously, it doesn't... They don't do it everywhere.
Right. Well, they can't.
They can't. There's just too not much. Enough, there's not enough manpower.
And too much area to cover. Yeah.
But yeah, like, I guess... And James, who's been on the show before, mm-hmm. has talked about that too in Arizona.
Fire captain, is he?
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. That they dig fire lines and stuff every spring and
for preventative measures. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
He's like, but there's just not enough people to do it.
Yeah, so you can only go so far. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Have you ever been on a ski lift?
Oh yeah, in a long time. But yeah.
I never have.
The last time I went skiing, I'm pretty sure I was 19. Mm. And I tried snowboarding for the second time that time. So I haven't actually been skiing in, geez, I don't know how long.
30 years almost?
Maybe more. I mean, really. I tried snowboarding the first time, I remember, my senior year in high school.
Okay.
And then that next winter.
That was about 30 years ago.
Geez, that would have been 96, I think. Yeah. Almost 30, but that's... I don't think I've been skiing or snowboarding since. It's not... Nobody in my life really does that, so...
Yeah, well, you have some family members that do ski occasionally.
But nobody I'm, like, really close with.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not like your sisters tend to ski.
No, my close friends here, like, no, they don't ski. Yeah, mm-hmm. Chad used to. Mm-hmm. Chad, who has also
yes,
been on the
yes,
pod.
Yes, on the Woodstock episode.
but he stopped going because his knee got messed up. He stopped going, like, 10 yeah. years ago, probably.
Yeah, you got to be super careful. And as you age, if you're not an athlete,
if I tried to do it today, like, I would be just, I wouldn't be able to walk. I'd be so sore. Yeah. The amount of, like, stress that is on, like, your lower body.
Yeah.
Trying your back, to stay, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, trying.
Your knees.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Trying to stay, like, in a certain position, mm-hmm. being able to switch from stance to stance and mm-hmm. while going, however fast you're going, that's, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think all the skiing days are behind me. Snowboarding days, too.
I decided when I was 11, my skiing days were
behind. I'm going to go with it's been 28 years since I've been on a ski lift. Wow.
I never have. I wouldn't mind going on a lift, but...
I would do that, yeah.
Then I would take the lift back down,
because
there is no way.
Well, that's what you do.
You just stay on it as it goes around.
You just don't get off.
I would also like to do a gondola, except for we did those... horrible disasters, the cable car disasters.
Yeah, but we've also been in a drinking
the Ferris wheel.
Ferris
Vegas.
Wheel. Yeah.
The high roller.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun though.
Mm-hmm. It was.
But we were getting lit like 300
well,
feet in
Vegas.
The air. Yeah. It's like shot, yes, shot. Picture. Shot.
Yeah, that bartender was pushing.
Feeding it.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yep.
We were not turning them down.
No, not really. The primary method of avalanche control was the use of... We already said that. All right, so they were doing these gelatin dynamite sticks. They would also cut known avalanche routes,
sure.
setting off avalanches with their skis. Yeah. Oh, okay. The final method was the use, of military artillery. That escalated quickly. They had a.
I mean, that really got out of hand.
I know, right? They had a gunner's post on the property and would use the same explosive rounds used in World War II to blast far-off snow packs on the mountain's upper ridges to trigger avalanches at a distance. That's interesting. Yeah. Shoot the snow.
Well, in this case, blow up the snow.
Yeah. Former employees of Alpine Meadows who were interviewed in the documentary all agreed it was an exciting job with an
yeah.
element of danger.
Yeah.
It was kind of like the Wild West. That could just describe the late 70s, early 80s.
That's very much good.
A group of late 20s to early 30s ski bums up in the mountains of Colorado playing with bombs. But despite a lot of them seeing it as fun, at the end of the day, they all knew their work was extremely important to the safety of visitors at the resort. And felt confident that their methods would be effective in preventing the big one. That would change in the final days of March 1982 when the area was hit with a severe storm that paralyzed the communities surrounding Alpine Meadows. Mm. Due to the continuous snowfall and wind gusts up to 100 miles per hour, major roadways were difficult to traverse. By March 29th, most of the ski resorts in the area were closed. News stations reported a record-breaking amount of snowfall, which was unusual in the late into the spring. That is pretty late.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, in these mountain climates, you never know.
Unpredictable.
Yeah.
Some estimations were that the area received a total of 11 feet of snow in 7 days.
Jesus.
That's a lot of snow.
That's intense.
That is intense.
I've never been through that.
11 feet of snow?
Not in a... I mean, maybe over the course of a winter, but...
Within 7 days?
No. I mean, I think the worst I've ever gotten hit with living up north, because, I mean, feet of snow is a... It's quite a feat.
But, yeah.
Like, maybe 3 or 4 feet in a day, and then it'll tamper off a little bit.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But 11 feet in a week.
11 feet.
That's nuts.
That is.
That's having 4 feet one day, then 3 days later, another 4 feet, and then 3 feet...
Yeah, right.
That's too much.
It could bury a house, basically.
I was going to say, and you can't really, you can't landscape that. What is a plow going to do?
Right.
Like nothing.
Yeah. Wait for the melt.
Yeah.
Wait for the
spring. That's really
thaw.
The only choice you've got.
Yeah.
Jeez. I hope all of these houses and like public spaces were on stilts, but I'm guessing probably not.
Yeah, I don't, that's interesting. I wonder if they do they build...
I would think they would do that.
Houses on stilts in area of heavy snowfall?
I would think they would today.
I don't know. I've never seen that. I've only seen stilt houses in the water.
Sure.
Huh, that's interesting. I don't know. On the morning of March 31st, Jim Plenn woke up to the wind howling outside his cabin. Upon arriving at Alpine Meadows, he made his way to the summit terminal building, which housed the ski patrol headquarters, administrative offices, the ski school, and a locker room for the staff. He noticed that overnight, their instruments recorded readings of wind gusts over 125 miles per hour.
Nuts, man.
The highest
really
reading.
Is.
Yeah, yeah.
And the cold that's going to come with a wind gust in the winter.
Oh,
that,
yes.
That fucking, that heavy.
There was red ink dripping from the paper readouts as a result of the needle swinging wildly back and forth. That is bizarre.
Like it couldn't hold it on the... Yeah. Like it's just, it's,
it was moving so quick that the ink was just flying out of it.
That's
not good.
We might have a problem.
That's not good.
This thing is so powerful, it's making our machines fucking...
What a great visual, though, for like a horror movie or
sure.
something.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Well, that's what I have a feeling this is going to turn into.
Yeah. Bernie was already there and called the general manager of Alpine Meadows and advised that the resort remain closed. However, even with the ski area closed to the public, the team still had a job to do. They needed to go out into the storm to evaluate the situation and purge the new snowfall to prevent a debilitating buildup. Yeah, I imagine once it gets a certain depth, like, you can't control it.
Yeah. So well, you got to make the attempt, but I mean, if this thing just keeps coming, which it sounds like it does, I mean,
Yeah, at what point do you give up and wait for the melt?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, this is 1982, so they probably have plows and snow blowers and things like that, but with an accumulation like that, that just after a while, that's
ineffective.
It's just not going to be effective at all, so.
Three ski patrol members, including Meredith Watson, then the only woman on ski patrol, rode up the lift the night before. Their destination was a small shack at the top of the mountain where they would spend the night so that they could wake up early to start purging the cornices on the ridge. They only expected to be up there for one night. In their packs, they had the explosive charges and a single cardboard box of food. In the morning, the wind was still blowing gusts of over 100 miles per hour, so the lifts weren't safe to use.
Yeah. No, hell no.
It is, no.
Because you're high off the ground in certain spots on those lifts.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you're about 50, 60 feet in the air.
You could get blown off.
Right off.
Literally, yeah. And Jeez. Snow is not always soft.
No, not from that height.
No, especially not from that height. No. Did you get the... When we lived in Minnesota, especially when we moved back... there was always a crunchy layer of ice on top of course, the snow.
Yes.
So you could basically, if you walked carefully, you could walk on top of it. And then if you stamped your foot, you'd break
through. Because it was always cold enough where that top layer would just get like that...
slicked.
Yeah.
Yeah, or iced up. Mm-hmm. And then if you broke through, there after like that crust, there was all this powder underneath. Yeah. Yeah.
And then it was a little bit of powder, and then it was really crunchy. You could make a nice snowball.
There you go. I never gotten snowball bites. Didn't really do that. Man. It sounds painful.
I guess it could be.
Meredith and her fellow ski patrol members were directed to go out and shoot a specific peak. As she prepared to light the charge, she recalls seeing a spark over a foot long. The rushing impact of the wind-driven snow against the surrounding rocks was creating a buildup of static electricity. This sounds like a horror movie. Yeah. Oh, wow. I didn't know that, like, there could just be a spark from static in the air. That's bizarre.
Well, I mean, remember in Oppenheimer, there was a concern that the atmosphere could catch on fire.
Yes.
He was like, well, what are the chances? He's like, it's not zero.
That's right. They were like, there is a chance we'll just wipe out the planet. There is that that chance. It's not a 0% chance.
Yeah, it's not 0%.
Slim, but it's not zero.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're saying there's a chance.
They quickly decided it was too dangerous to light the explosives by hand. Uh-huh. Ditched their packs somewhere where they wouldn't get buried and made their way back to the shack. Back at the resort's base area, two other members of Ski Patrol, Lanny Johnson and Tom Kibau, attempted to ski up the ridge to purge the new buildups of snow. However, they came to a point where the powder was up to their waists. Exhausted and struggling to break a path, Lanny turned and said to Tom, quote, I feel like there's a dragon under this snow.
Jeez.
Yeah, trudging through snow is bizarrely exhausting.
Oh,
it's exhausting, incredibly exhausting. Yeah.
Because it's not the best footing, and you're having to lift bring your legs up pretty high and do that over and over again. Yeah, you'll get wiped out pretty quick doing that.
So imagine waist height.
Mm-hmm.
Unable to make headway to their target, an avalanche starting zone near a landmark on the mountain known as the Poma Rocks, they decided to head back down to the lodge to regroup and come up with a new plan. To this day, Lanny questions what would have happened if they had made it to their destination and if it would have made a difference in what was to come. Kristen is very good at, like, harbingers, right? Like, foreshadowing. Mm-hmm. Foreshadowing. Very good, Kristen. Because I'm like, what's going to happen? Back on the ground, you can tell I've not seen the documentary. I've actually never heard of this disaster.
I haven't either.
Unable to make, already said that. Back on the ground, visibility was terrible. The Forest Service snow rangers came up to fire the artillery, and Jim recalls they must have shot twice the normal amount of rounds into the blinding whiteness of the ridge. Surveying the landscape, Larry and Jim thought they saw avalanche debris, which eased their minds that they were making progress. By noon that day, with the wind still whipping and snowfall increasing rapidly, Bernie sent most of the employees home, save for a small crew led by Larry and Jim. They decided to drive over to the neighboring Squaw Valley ski area. Author's note. This highly problematic name was changed to Palisades Tahoe in 2021, but at the time, this is what the area was known as, which is why I included it. Their plan was to ride up their KT-22 lift and access Alpine Meadows ski trails from the back ridge and start their mitigation efforts from there. On their way out of the parking lot, Jim spied two cross-country skiers approaching the base area of Alpine Meadows. It was Anna Conrad, a 22-year-old ski lift operator, and her boyfriend, Frank Yateman, who was visiting her from UC Davis. Although Anna had been given the day off due to the storm, by mid-afternoon the pair had become a little antsy and decided to trek up to the lodge. Jim told them they needed to get up to the lodge and stay put until they had finished their control work. He told them, quote, it's too dangerous to be out.
Yeah.
As Larry, Jim, and their team drove on, both men looked around at the snow packs gathering on the slopes overseeing the roadways. Something about the snow that day seemed different, more ominous. Larry said there was an audible tinkling sound to the snow as it moved, almost like it was alive with electricity. I don't want to be able to hear snow. Thank you very much. Yeah. This all sounds like a horror movie to me. Like the snow is sentient, you know, and is gonna.
Well, rah! I mean, there are certain tribes that think, you know, wind, the sun, there are certain spirits things and that elements are, that yeah. are sentient.
Yeah.
So.
Meanwhile,
I'm just glad I don't think so, because that sounds fucking scary.
It does sound really scary.
I don't want the wind to like have a plan. I just want it to happen randomly.
I guess the closest I would come to is, on some level, I feel like nature has a, quote, spirit, in that it's nature's world and I'm just living in it, so I'm going to respect it as such.
I mean, it is.
Yes.
I mean, really.
Yes.
Yeah, we've seen time and time again how nature has no respect for anything.
No. No,
it's like
we mentioned that many a time.
And you just deal with it.
I have a feeling we're about to find that out too here. Meanwhile, 27-year-old ski patroller Jeffrey Jake Smith. I wonder why his name is Jeffrey, but his nickname is Jake. Okay, Jake. Was assigned to take a snowmobile to the upper road. Like if you were David Jim. You know, I guess not. It'd be like if you were David Dawn.
Yeah.
Anyway, I just found that funny. Anyway, Jake was assigned to take a snowmobile to the upper road and help stop any motorists who might be in the path of their controlled slides. At approximately 3:45 p.m., from his position in the parking lot, Jake spotted the first signs of trouble. I'm not yawning because of the story. It's excellent. I'm yawning because I'm tired. And urgently shouted over his radio, avalanche.
Mm.
The group at Squaw Valley heard garbled shouting over their radios, but couldn't make it out. Jim called another employee who was at home and asked him if he knew what had happened. He relayed that he didn't know for sure, but that they needed to get back to the base area quickly. As they drove, it seemed that news had spread that something bad had happened at Alpine Meadows, but no one quite knew what it was. Residents of the area were coming out of their homes with shovels ready to help. That's very sweet. I don't know how much good shovels are going to do.
Right.
But I guess it's better than nothing.
Yes.
Yeah. As Jim and Larry's team rounded a corner and came up over a hill that would have given them a full view of Alpine Meadows, their hearts dropped and their eyes widened. The 70,000-square-foot A-frame Summit Terminal building stood as a wooden skeleton of the former structure. Doors and windows had been shattered, the walls had been completely blown out, and the contents of the building were now debris sprawled out in the snow amongst tree limbs, power lines, and pieces of heavy equipment over an area the size of a football field.
Jeez.
Yeah. You forget that, like, you can imagine, like, a huge flood of water, sure. Right? Snow is kind of same difference, not literally kinetically, but as in power, you know, very similar.
Maybe even more so.
Because it's more solid. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I guess, yeah, it's just another version of water, snow, mm-hmm. just cold water. three survivors were found almost immediately. They were Alpine.
That's good.
That is good. They were Alpine Meadows employees Randy Buck, Jeff Scover. This one just went by Jeff, not Jake. And Ted DeFelice, who had taken cover and had been able to get their heads and arms above the snow, which undoubtedly saved their lives.
Yeah, oh yeah.
As they began to recount their experience, a fuller picture of the devastation emerged. The three young men had been in the ski patrol office with Bernie and Beth Morrow, 22-year-old ski lift, a 22-year-old ski lift operator who aspired to join ski patrol, and was assisting Bernie with recording the day's avalanche control measures. They described hearing Jake cry out avalanche over the radio. Bernie grabbed the microphone and shouted, "Where?" but got no response. Seconds later, the building started to shake around them.
Jeez.
Giant steel girders that held the roof above started to swing wildly back and forth. That's not good. They heard a horrifying rumbling sound. It was then that the building was hit with a massive air blast, which shattered windows and doors. Oh, so the sonic boom comes mm-hmm. first, almost. Behind that was a gigantic wave of snow. In seconds, the office was completely gone. Bernie and Beth had disappeared. Anna and her boyfriend, Frank, who had been in the ski patrol office just a second ago, but were headed towards the locker room to grab some of their gear, were also nowhere to be found. But that wasn't the end of it. The thundering tsunami of snow that had smashed through the building continued out into the parking lot. It was there that the resort's heavy equipment manager, Mike Alves, witnessed two adults and a child walking up toward the lodge. The group consisted of a father, his 11-year-old daughter, and their friend, who were on vacation and had been staying at one of the nearby condos. They had been feeling cooped up from the storm and decided to head out for fresh air and to see if the restaurant at the lodge was open. As they walked towards him through the parking lot, Mike heard several quick snapping sounds, which he only later realized was the sound of 100-year-old pine trees snapping like toothpicks from the sheer force of the snow barreling down from the slopes. In what felt like an instant, the avalanche arrived, and he watched the trio, who had started running for their lives, get swept away.
Yeah.
They were now presumably lost under 10 to 20 feet of snow. Larry took control as accident site commander. Armed with the knowledge that 8 people were missing and that their approximate last known locations,
Well, that's,
the rescue mission began.
That's a great thing to know.
Yeah.
Where they were last seen.
Yes. Although the impact could have carried
them.
Sure. But you have a
You've
place
got a
to
place
start.
To start. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Once buried, chances of survival go down considerably after 30 minutes, so the clock was ticking. Over 100 volunteers joined Alpine Meadows staff in the search. Making the rescue more challenging was the fact that all of Ski Patrol's equipment, including their search probes,
buried.
Skis, and shovels, had all been housed in the summit terminal building when the avalanche struck.
Yeah.
Yeah. These life-saving tools and instruments were now buried or broken, strewn amongst the terrain like garbage. There was a cache of supplies at the summit shack where Meredith Watson and the two other Ski Patrol employees were stationed, but they had been told to stay put. The need for equipment didn't outweigh putting their lives at risk.
It's too far to go and then come back anyway. You've got a half hour.
There's that, but also they could be in danger leaving that building.
Yeah.
And you want to rescue people, but you don't want to kill more people in the process. So. As the search and rescue efforts got underway, Lanny recalls having the idea that he should turn his beacon on. Members of the Ski Patrol crew at Alpine Meadows employed the use of rescue beacons called Skaties, I guess, that could be used to detect other beacons nearby. If Beth or Jake had theirs on at the time of the avalanche, Lanny hoped he would be able to pick up their signal. Almost immediately after turning his on, in fact, he got a signal and followed it to a particular spot in the snow. It was then that another member of Ski Patrol, Casey Jones, walked past him. Lanny asked, "Do you have your beacon on?" And Casey replied, "Yes."
Mm.
Lanny sighed, figuring that was the signal he was picking up, and resumed searching elsewhere. He would only later learn that at the time he had been standing directly above the body of Beth Morrow. Meanwhile, another group was told to go out and look for Jake in the area where he was last known to have been seen. They found the mangled snowmobile quickly, and after some digging down in the snow, Jake Smith became the first victim found. The heartbreaking reality set in that this avalanche had claimed lives. Not long after, the bodies of the two men who had been in the parking lot, Dr. Leroy Bud Nelson... Leroy is Bud. I guess it's okay. And David Hahn were recovered. We won't laugh at Bud. Poor Bud. As the night came to an end, Ski Patrol members took it upon themselves to load the victims onto a snowcat to transport them to the local coroner's office.
Yeah.
The victims' bodies were in contorted positions and had essentially frozen in place. That would be really awful to see.
Yeah.
It was a gut-wrenching sight, but the rescuers were determined to press on. In their own words, quote, "You have to turn it off, shut down the emotion, you've got a job to do," end quote. That's how I feel anytime there's like an emergent situation.
Yeah, like things need
like
to happen.
Like your brain switches, and it's like, you'll be fucked up over this, but we'll deal with the emotions later.
Yeah, we're gonna turn off emotions for the next couple of hours.
It's sheer survival right now. Exactly. They would later learn all 3 victims had died of asphyxia. They had all been buried alive and essentially drowned in snow. Day 1. Thursday, April 1st, the ski resort was still a very hazardous area. So this is the next day. The threat of another avalanche weighed heavy on the rescuer's mind, but especially Jim, who was wondering silently to himself throughout those first moments following the avalanche if he had missed something that caused this. With the press flocking to the resort to report on the disaster, Jim and Lanny, desperate to get to the top of the mountain and use their remaining charges to blast cornices to prevent a secondary avalanche and clear the way for safety crews and other rescuers to get to the resort, actually commandeered a local TV news helicopter.
I was going to say that'd be the only way. Yeah.
KCRA Channel 3 in Sacramento. The television station pilot unwittingly became their bomb pilot. In the air over the resort, Jim finally got a good look at the magnitude of the fracture lines and was shocked by what he saw. It looked as if four separate avalanche areas had released their snow as one massive slide. Jeez. Yikes. This was a devastating moment as Jim realized their previous control work had not been effective and that the area was indeed under a very real threat of another deadly avalanche. On the ground, volunteers worked tirelessly, scouring the base camp area for any signs of life, but deep down they knew that their chances of finding survivors were dwindling. Later that day, the bodies of Laura Nelson, the 11-year-old child who had been with her father and his friend in the parking lot, and Beth Morrow were recovered. Beth was over 100 feet from where she had last been seen.
Sure.
She got swept pretty far out.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, closer to what remained of the summit terminal building, Lanny recalls spotting a, quote, fuzzy thing, pointing out of the snow where rescuers were digging. Slowly, he began to realize that what he was staring at was the back of a human head, Frank Yateman. His body was crushed up against one of the electric heaters. It's at this point in the film that Lanny explains the FaceTime he experienced finding Frank and being able to imagine him from his frozen expression of the shock, pain, and fear he must have felt in his final moments. But here again, Lanny tells himself, push it down. You still have a job to do.
Mm-hmm.
He figured Anna and Frank were together at the time of the avalanche and yelled into the snow mound, Anna, if you're in there, we're coming to get you.
Hmm.
On Friday, April 2nd, Ski Patrol mobilized at first light. They were desperate to try and purge the 103 inches of new snow the area had received overnight. Jeez. Sorting through the debris, looking for any signs of life, was slow-going and difficult work, made worse by the fact that the rescue dogs they had brought in were giving false alerts. This was the early days of using canine rescue and recovery teams, and the area was littered with human scent, including dirty ski socks, boots, and bits and pieces of an employee lunch they had kept in their lockers. However, one of the dogs, a German Shepherd named Bridget, took off towards a triangular hole of debris near the summit building. Her handler, Roberta Huber, recalls her demeanor had changed drastically as she jumped up and down, wagging her tail and barking near the opening of the hole. As rescue efforts were taking place, Jim surveyed the skies, trying to detect the faintest hint of danger. Yeah, they're still in a danger zone. Oh, yeah. Much. The winds were starting to pick up, and the possibility of a second avalanche was still weighing heavy on his mind. Roberta approached him and told him that Bridget was signaling near the building. She felt strongly that Bridget had found Anna and that Anna was alive. Lanny and a small crew went with Roberta and started to dig down the hole. They had made it about 10 feet halfway down when the bad weather started to intensify. It was then that Jim made the difficult decision to pause the search. It was no longer safe to continue with the rescue effort. That must have been really hard to say. This really sucks.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to risk anyone else's life here.
But like you were saying too, like, you're in a rescue effort, you have to, preserving life has to be on your mind as well.
Yes, absolutely. Protecting the rescuers, for sure. Yeah. So it was no longer safe to continue with the rescue effort. He instructed Lanny and his group to board up the hole to protect the progress they had made so they could get back in when the weather cleared. Unfortunately, this is now into days 3 and 4. Unfortunately, Mother Nature had other plans. Saturday morning, the Lake Tahoe community awoke to blizzard conditions. Unable to press on with their rescue efforts, those in the community were allowed a momentary reprieve, albeit a somber one. That Saturday was Jake Smith's funeral. What are the cats getting into?
I don't know.
All right, we're happy to report the cats were just literally getting into a bag that was sitting on the floor. So everything is fine. So the storm continued into Sunday with whiteout conditions. The avalanche control crews worked tirelessly trying to stabilize the snowpacks forming on cliffs around Alpine Meadows, but it was no use. They were going to have to wait it out. So now we're into day five. On Monday, April 5th, rescuers woke up to sunshine and a clear blue sky and wasted no time resuming their efforts. After 5 days at the top of the mountain, the break in the weather finally allowed Meredith Watson and her group to descend the mountain by helicopter. They were stuck up there that whole time.
Yeah.
With one box of food. Stationed at the summit shack since Tuesday night, the cardboard box of food and supplies they had brought had dwindled to one carton of milk between the three of them. Exhausted and hungry, rather than receiving rest and reprieve, they immediately joined the recovery efforts at the base area. Wow. I would be so hangry.
Yeah.
I would not.
You wouldn't be able to do it.
No, I wouldn't. I would not. I'm delicate. That's just how it is. Roberta and Bridget were already back at the hole in the building debris. As Lanny and his team dug down deeper, level by level, they came upon a piece of plywood. Lanny pulled it aside out of the dark, and out of the darkness, a hand emerged and reached for a fistful of snow.
Jesus Christ.
They all gasped, and Meredith shouted, "Did you see that?" Lanny shouted into the darkness of the opening, "Anna, is that you?" A weak, raspy voice replied, "Yes, it's me."
God damn.
Anna Conrad was alive. Jesus. And buried. This buried. Is buried alive.
Mm-hmm.
It was buried alive. She was buried alive. Well, they all were, but not all of them were unburied alive.
Yeah.
She had been trapped under 15 feet of snow in an air pocket, ironically, no bigger than a coffin, and in complete darkness. So she really was, that's really is being buried alive.
Fucking yeah.
She had been in the employee locker room when the avalanche hit. I'm going to guess that Anna had claustrophobia for the rest of her life.
Yeah, probably.
I would. That's how I would react. So the lockers fell and knocked her under a bench.
I was going to say, probably
the way the snow fell, right?
Exactly what I was thinking.
Or came at her. But the way they had... Okay, so the way the lockers fell had formed a shield, preventing her from being crushed and leaving room to breathe. Severely dehydrated, freezing, and suffering from a major concussion... That may have helped her, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, if you're dazed enough and just hopefully not fully mentally present, that would be the only way to make it through that. She was in and out of consciousness over those 5 days she had been buried, but recalls hearing the rescue workers calling her name and then leaving. They had been completely unaware that she had been yelling back. Of course, they couldn't hear her.
No.
10 feet of snow or 15 feet of snow, yeah. An experienced outdoor enthusiast, she tried to stay warm and survived by eating the little bit of snow around her.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dangerously sick on that fifth day, she told interviewers that she was reaching for snow that fell into her hole to ease her thirst when the rescue team discovered her.
Hmm.
On a semi-lighthearted note, as an animal lover, the efforts of Roberta Huber and her dog Bridget is widely recognized as the first successful live rescue of an avalanche victim in North America.
Okay.
And many
That's
credit
pretty good.
The pair. Yeah. Many credit the pair with helping legitimize the use of search and rescue dogs in the U.S.
Hmm.
Nice. However, the sheer exhilaration and joy the rescuers experienced after finding Anna alive would be short-lived. Late that afternoon, the search came to a sobering conclusion. As rescuers found the body of Bernie Kingery, or Kingery, I'm not sure which, 100 feet from what remained of the summit building.
Mm.
Their leader, a man who had spent the better part of his life developing avalanche research, mitigation, and control efforts, had been swept away by the very disaster he had tried so hard to prevent. His fist was frozen clenched, almost as if in a fighting stance. Now the aftermath. In the wake of the avalanche at Alpine Meadows, the families of those killed in the parking lot took Alpine Meadows to court for negligence.
Yeah, sure.
That's
it happens.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah. There had been no gate or anyone stationed at the bottom of the lot to keep people from the condos from walking over. Okay, I get the point. Yeah. Despite the area's elevated risk for avalanches, the prosecution argued that the public had been kept in the dark and that the three victims had been completely unaware of the dangers present. I would sure guess they had no idea, otherwise they wouldn't have just, well, yeah, let's go out.
You can kind of see that, because you can kind of see, like, there should have been some sort of alert system. Like,
yeah.
You're in the mountains, like, okay, like, for the next 15 minutes, don't go outside because we're doing these certain things and... or whatever, just right. You know,
yeah.
But again, it seems like it came upon everybody so fast that there wasn't time to warn anybody anyway.
Although the staff kind of knew,
yeah.
So, but it's not like they had a system in place to stop people from coming. So I get the point that there should have been some sort of system. I don't think that the staff was being negligent.
No. I don't know.
I think
just
that
saying,
there just wasn't a good system in place, which was maybe the resorts,
and that the avalanche came on way too fast, and
Jim Plenn, in light of Bernie's death, was tasked with testifying on behalf of the resorts. His testimony continued for a grueling 11 days. What? That's awful. Dozens of other avalanche experts and scientists also testified. The jury deliberated for several days, but ultimately it was concluded that multiple different avalanche paths had combined into one massive slide, resulting in an avalanche with a spread and force that far surpassed what anyone on ski patrol had previously observed or could have expected.
Well, it's almost like the, it almost sounds like the crowd crush at...
Hillsborough?
Yes. Because you had all those gates that were opened up that shouldn't have been.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Which caused all this flow, which, you know, not that these gates, but you know what I mean? You have different masses of humans converging on one another.
Different masses of snow.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then creating just a frickin'...
But unlike Hillsborough, I don't think
the police were not at fault.
Well, and I don't think the resort was, like, basically causing it either.
No, and they were trying to do what they could to prevent it.
Yeah.
That is the irony of that one person dying.
Yeah.
So
the disaster was ruled an act of nature that ended in tragedy and not the fault of any one ski member of the ski patrol team. Or the resort itself, and all proper forecasting protocols and avalanche control procedures were followed. Jim left the ski area that following winter. I'd say the only thing is that this didn't happen before, but now you know it can happen, so what are you going to do next time to protect people from the area, you know, basically. In the weeks and months that followed the tragedy, Anna Conrad underwent several amputations, including the loss of her right leg below the knee and all of the toes on her left foot. Despite this, she went to walk across the stage at her college graduation 3 months later and using an artificial limb, skied again in December 1982.
Jeez.
She was skiing by 7 months
just
later.
Just like, all right, just throw that, or 8 months throw later. That on me. We'll figure it out from here.
Well, she was young, too, she was like, sure.
And I mean, prosthetics in 1982, let's think about that. Probably.
Yeah, it wasn't bionic like they are now.
No. Like now, like if like, oh, like I just had my leg amputated last week and I'm skiing now. Like people would be like, okay.
They would feel more.
It's like that kind of makes sense.
To be fair, I do believe that it is a lot more complicated than that for rehabbing from an amputation.
Oh, of course it is. Yeah.
There's actually, I need to follow her again. So my TikTok got wiped out several months ago and I had to like rebuild it.
Uh-oh.
But I need to follow her again. Footless Joe is her handle.
If you happen to be listening.
Yeah, Footless Joe. She had a horseback, like at least one really bad horseback riding accident as like a child or a teenager. And she could walk and everything, but her leg was just in constant pain like 100% of the time, especially like her ankle area.
Yeah.
It was horrible chronic pain. And she ended up making the decision to amputate below the knee. Yes, from pain management, which obviously is a really dramatic decision, but also goes to show how painful it was, right? And she talks a lot about like the struggles with being an amputee and the disabling. I mean, she still has plenty of pain, yeah. right? And just all the peculiarities of using a prosthetic, and she also uses a wheelchair and other stuff. But anyway. So this year, March 31st, 2024, which was a few weeks ago at this point, I missed that.
We only missed about 20 days.
Yeah. We'll mark the 42nd anniversary of the disaster. While certainly the deadliest, this is not the only avalanche at Alpine Meadows that has claimed lives.
Really?
Several years earlier, in March 1976, three skiers died in an avalanche in Beaver Bowl at Alpine Meadows. Bernie Kingery was the mountain manager at the time, and coworkers said the tragedy devastated him and made him even more dedicated to coming up with a dedicated avalanche control program. And yet, despite all of their control efforts, avalanches continue to happen. Additional fatalities at Alpine Meadows occurred in March 1990, February 2001, March 2012, December 2012, January 2020, and most recently, at the time of this writing, January 10th, 2024, when a skier was killed in an avalanche at the now renamed Palisades Tahoe, the sister resort of Alpine Meadows.
Wow.
The Alpine Meadows disaster serves as a reminder of the unforgiving, raw power of nature and the stark lesson that even with the best preparedness, we are at the mercy of the natural world. The key is awareness of the danger and the knowledge of when to surrender and get out of the way. And yet, the survivors and eyewitnesses who were present at the ski resort that fateful day urge us to remember that even when things appear to be their darkest, you can't give up, especially hope. Hmm. And that, my friends, wow. was the story of the 1982 Alpine Meadows Avalanche by Kristen H.
Excellent job, Kristen.
Excellent. First time script contributor. Hopefully not last time. Question mark. When's yes. the if, next one coming out, Kristen?
If anybody listening to this is like, well, I'm, if you're not feeling confident, just write one.
Mm-hmm.
Like it doesn't, you know.
That's what I do. Yeah, that's what I do that. Every
that's,
time.
That's how we. That's how we started. Like,
do you think we'll we're just, qualified yeah, we'll to do this? Write one. No. No.
Just write one, and we may or may not read it on said anniversary. We may or may not read it within a year or two. But,
or three.
Or three. Or four in one case, I believe.
Fortune favors the bold, not yes. the qualified.
Exactly. Yes. But that's...
That was really interesting. I had never heard of that. And we haven't covered many avalanches.
No. No, we haven't.
Especially two snow ones.
Two or three,
ones.
Maybe?
Yeah. Yeah. Because there's, well, I guess those are rock slides or landslides, but...
or mudslide, we've done yeah. one of those.
We did the one, it was one of our first miracle sods, the one where, in Australia, where just the one guy survived.
Yes.
So they were survivable, but not easily, you don't as
wanna,
poor Anna found out.
I was going to say, well, you don't really want to find out if they are or not.
Right.
Like, you just, yeah.
Yeah.
Rather just not be involved.
I'd rather not be buried alive.
Yeah.
Thank you. Just in the first place, you know, if I have to be buried alive, I'd like to survive, but I would prefer simply not to be buried alive in the first place.
Correct. Yes.
Yeah. That is still one of my, I would say that would be up there in creepy
pretty
things.
Pretty fucking, I think that'd be pretty scary for anybody,
yes.
no matter who you are.
Yes. Spoiler.
Because even if you're The Rock.
Uh-huh.
You're not getting out of being trapped right. under 15 feet of snow.
Right.
It's just not happening.
There is no human strength capable of unburying from 15 feet of snow.
No.
Yeah.
There's only Uma Thurman in Kill Bill Volume 2 where she can strike from 3 inches away.
And, oh, that's right. She broke out of... Do you know, I've never seen Kill Bill. But I do know that that scene,
because
mm-hmm. I don't know, it must just be in pop culture or something. Yeah. But
well, she learns how to kill somebody from 3 inches away because her instructor
just
is like
how she strikes.
Is like, what if your enemy is only 3 inches away from you? Because she's like, it hurts doing it so close. And he's like, well, whatever. So she learns how to do it, and then she later uses that to get out of the coffin.
Oh, okay.
By just being like. Psh. Because it keeps breaking her...
skin on her knuckles.
Yeah. Well, that too, and like probably just breaking her... Yeah. Spraining her hand. Mm-hmm. Fracturing. Anyway.
Well, I don't exactly rely on Quentin Tarantino for accuracy of reality.
That was real. Yeah, she got out of it.
Like, yeah, sure.
Yeah, they filmed it that way.
Yeah. While he was sitting out giving a really boring monologue about Madonna.
Probably.
But anyway.
It was not boring. It was funny.
Spoiler alert for the traitors. The traitors, if anyone wants to see it. The first season of both the British and the US one, one of their challenges is half of them get buried alive. And the other half have to find them. Now, it's a controlled environment, obviously.
Only so many episodes before they eat sheep balls.
That's fear factor.
That's what this is turning into, it sounds like.
No, they're burying
people alive.
No.
No, now you just bury people alive on like a normal show.
No. They were buried very shallowly, but they were still buried. And when the people came to dig them out, eventually when they popped open the coffin lid, like all this dirt came down on them. And I'm like, what they didn't consider was dirt getting in people's eyes. Yeah. And safety. I wonder if they covered that in the safety meaning.
Anyway, Kristen H., I'm sorry we've ruined your episode.
We stayed relatively on track,
at this point. But again, if you've been a longtime listener.
Yeah, she knows.
Then you know what to expect.
She knows. She's like, I expected nothing better from you.
So that was the 1982 Alpine Meadows Avalanche. This has been another episode of All Bad Things. I'm David.
I'm Rachel.
We'll see you next week.